Okay, so today we are going to talk about energy transfer and electron transfer. Right, here we go. So far we have been talking about spectroscopic transitions, and then we discussed photophysics, so basically what happens after excitation, what happens to excited state molecule, it relaxes. But we have not discussed one possible pathway for energy relaxation, which is energy transfer. And so what happens there is that so this red dot here is an excited molecule. The blue ones are solvent molecules. And the green and orange one are some specific molecules which can actually accept energy from this molecule over distance. So what happens is that excited molecule gives its energy to another molecule. And there are actually basically three mechanisms by which this can happen. And it can happen over long distance. And these different mechanisms function at different distances. And nature uses this mechanism. For example, in photosynthesis, the left diagram with the title energy antenna means that this is something which is used in photosynthesis. So basically on the right, we have a reaction center. And in the reaction center, we need energy from the photon, from the light. And the plant needs to collect this energy from light. And of course it can collect it via absorption, but it is more efficient to build a network of molecules which absorb energy, but there is no reaction center for each absorbing molecule. It wouldn't be efficient, but instead, some of the molecules absorb energy and it transfers its energy to the reaction center via energy transfer mechanism. And this is more economically effective than building a full reaction center for each absorbing molecule. So this is used in nature. On the right, we have an application. So this is molecular ruler. So this, indeed, it's tool ruler in the molecular dimensions, and the idea is that we have, for example, we have a complicated protein, and we would like to know some information about its structure, and what can be done is to attach a probe, two probe molecules, in certain part of the amino acid sequence, and then when you excite one of the molecules, it transfers its energy to another one, and the rate of the transfer depends on the distance. And if you measure this energy transfer rate, you can do it spectroscopically, you can determine the distance. And in this way, you can determine distance of two spots by spectroscopy. So it is a way to get structural information. And here you can see, this is about 5 nanometers, this distance. So in this case, it works over several nanometers, this energy transfer. So now let's go through three different mechanisms. The first one, we don't go through in very detail, but it is something which is easy to understand qualitatively, radiative energy transfer mechanism. In all of these cases, we have two molecules. We have donor, D, donor, and we have acceptor, A. And the donor is excited, and it gets D excited. And in this radiated energy transfer mechanism, it emits a photon. And when it emits a photon, there's acceptor molecule, which is on the ground state, and it absorbs the photon and gets excited. So this is something we have been discussing all the time. But the new aspect here is that so this happens in your sample in solution. So you have your excited donor molecule, and you have a solution, and you have acceptor molecule. So when there is fluorescence, for example, there is always chance that this fluorescence is absorbed by molecules in your solution. This is something to take into account. And for example, if you have a large concentration of acceptor molecules, it can, they can absorb the radiation to the extent that it already distorts the fluorescence spectrum. But this is something also to take into account in your experiment. But in any case, it is an energy transfer mechanism. It is called trivial mechanism. What is the distance over which this mechanism can work? How long distance or forward? In your opinion. Yes, both is correct. Of course, in principle, there is no limit. I mean, you see light from the stars, it comes to your eyes, the molecules absorb, so basically it can function over light years, so over huge distances. But of course, in practice, and then it depends on the concentration of A, so how much is absorbed. So, and the conditions which affect the rate is of course the emission quantum yield. So if this is very low, most of the energy is relaxed by a non-radiative mechanism, and then this doesn't take place, this radiative mechanism. So emission quantum yield is important. Concentration of A, of course, the more A you have around, more probabilities to absorb. And this is a key point which affects all the mechanisms, the overlap of the emission spectrum of donor and the absorption spectrum acceptor. Of course, if there is no overlap, there is no energy transfer. This can be described with this kind of overlap integral, J. So it is an integral from 0 to infinity, basically. And this ID, this means the emission spectrum donor, and epsilon A is the absorption spectrum acceptor, and over we integrate over the spectrum. So down here we see the idea. So we have emission spectrum, we have absorption spectrum, and here they overlap, and if you integrate, you get this kind of pictorial representation of the overlap integral, and depending on how large this is, the larger probability there is for energy transfer. In the energy diagram upstairs here, it means that some of the transitions must be resonant. So for here, for example, 0 to 0 emission would be resonant 0 to 3 absorption of the acceptor. So it is kind of a resonant condition. There has to be transitions at the same energy, and then this energy transfer can happen. Well, we don't go into more detail here. We understand this in principle. So, but if we want to model this, how it affects your spectrum, how strong it is, it's not so easy anymore. So this is something to. This is a specific task, but in principle, now we understand this. This is sequential emission and absorption. Okay, but now we go to radiation-less energy transfer theory. And this means that there is basically no emission and absorption, but this happens non-radiative with this energy transfer. And we start from Fermi's golden rule. So now this is a kind of a simple derivation. So probability for this kind of transition. So we have a two systems, donor and acceptor, and we make a transition from donor excited acceptor ground state to donor ground state acceptor excited. And this we can describe with this Fermi golden rule type of expression, where we have final state, initial state, and some Hamiltonian which couples these initial and final states. And now we can make a simple, this is much rigorously correct, but this is a simple way to understand this. So initial wave function, let it be a product of donor excited wave function and accept the ground state wave function. And final state is a product of donor ground state and accept the excited state wave function. And the coupling, we have two terms without going into detail. We have exchange coupling and Coulomb coupling. So exchange coupling means exchange of electrons. So basically, now we can already guess that for this mechanism, we have to have an overlap of the wave function, significant overlap. So this is a very short collision distance mechanism. But Coulomb mechanism is an interaction between charge distributions. So this can be longer range. Now, if we plug this Hamiltonian in, we get basically two main terms. And for energy transfer rate, and here on the left, we have exchange. So basically, we have the initial and final wave functions and exchange Hamiltonian or coupling term. And on the right, we have Coulomb coupling term. So basically, now we go look into more detail of these two mechanisms. And let's start from the Coulomb mechanism. So starting point is that we have a oscillating dipole, and that induces oscillating dipole in other molecule. This is kind of classical idea. So we have excited donor, ground state absorb acceptor. And even if we think classically, if we have a make an oscillating dipole here, it will induce oscillating dipole in April. This is a kind of a classical way of understanding this energy transfer. And it has to be a resonant. Okay. So this is so basically this resonance condition is important. So we must have resonant states for donor and acceptor. Now so now we can derive this not rigorously but simply the so-called Förster theory. So this is named according to Theodore Förster, who developed this quantum mechanic theory for energy transfer by a Coulomb mechanism. And this is so-called, if you encounter the term FRET, this is a fluorescence resonance energy transfer, very much used in biological imaging. So it is this mechanism. And this is very important, since this energy transfer is a common phenomenon, and the impact of Förster theory was that he was able to associate this energy transfer rate to experimental observables, something we can measure. And the starting point for him was that to start from interaction energy between two dipoles. So classically, so basically dipole-dipole interaction. It turns out that dipole-dipole interaction energies is proportional to this term, where we have dipole moment of donor times dipole moment of acceptor divided by distance to the third power. So this is the dipole-dipole interaction. And now Förster's idea was to replace these classical dipoles by quantum mechanical transition dipole. That was his idea. And then to use Fermi's golden rule to calculate the rate. Now let's see what happens. So first of all, from the point two, you remember that the rate is the square of the matrix element or interaction element. And from there, we get the result that energy transfer rate depends on squares of the transition dipoles divided by sixth power of the distance. So now we get the distance dependence. And further, of course, we have theoretical expression for transition dipoles. So we could plug it in and then we would be happy. But the problem is that it's not so easy to calculate. So Förster's idea was to replace these with experimental observables. And you remember that we can obtain this transition dipole moment from integrated absorption coefficient or radiative rate constant, for example, from the lifetime. So this now we plug into the expression. So for both squares of the transition dipole moments, we use either integrated absorption coefficient or a radiative rate constant. And now we plug in. So now our expression becomes so that, of course, it's natural to consider for the donor the radiative rate constant and for the acceptor for the integrated absorption coefficient. So now we plug in these, so the radiative rate constant for donor and integrated molar absorption coefficient for acceptor. So now finally our rate becomes this. Now we have a couple of additional factors I will explain soon. Especially we have the J. And J is a spectral overlap integral where we have absorbed this molar absorption, integrated molar absorption coefficient also there because it's convenient. We will see soon better. But finally, if we additionally take into account the medium effects, so we are usually insolvent. So this we use take into account by a refractive index. We get this expression, which is it's a kind of a practical expression because we have we use a numerical factor here which takes into account the constants. And overall, now the rate for energy transfer is proportional to this expression where we have this numerical factor, and then we have the radiative rate constant for donor. We have a refractive index to the fourth power in denominator, and then we have the distance to the sixth power in the denominator. And then we have two additional factors, J, which we'll see soon what it is. So it's a spectral overlap integral. And we have the is it kappa squared? And that is a so-called orientation factor. Because you see, if you have two dipoles, it depends on what is the orientation of these dipoles. So if they are parallel, if they are perpendicular. So depending on the orientations, the dipole-dipole interaction varies. But so this is close to one, but this squared factor is for random orientation where all the possible directions are integrated, it's 2/3. But then and this is used when we have freely moving molecules in a solution, for example, then you use 2/3. But if you have specific interaction head to tail, it's 2 or parallel, it's 1. So but in any case, it's a simple factor. If you want to do the trigger, this is a full orientation dependent. So this vector equation where we have a transition dipoles and dot product, A and B, and then we have the two additional factors where we have R, which is the distance vector between them. So this is a full expression for the orientation. But if you, from this, you calculate these specific situations, you get the result that I showed on the previous one. Okay, interestingly, you can see that if the mu A and mu B are orthogonal, this dot product is 0. Okay, but the second term is not necessarily 0, but if in addition one other mu A or mu B is orthogonal to the distance vector R, then also the second term goes to 0. So there is a specific orientation when the energy transfer rate goes to 0. So it is possible that if they have a certain orientation, it goes to 0. It's because in this there's no dipole-dipole interaction anymore. Now going back to J, so here this is J. How it looks like this is now in terms of wave number. So spectra are reported in wave number now. So this overlap integral contains product of the emission spectrum of donor. We will see soon. In a bit more detail, and then times the absorption spectrum or molar absorption coefficient of acceptor divided by nu to the fourth power. Okay, so this is like an overlap integral, but the F integral, which is the emission spectrum, is normalized. So So it is the emission spectrum divided by the integral of the emission spectrum. That means that it only depends on the form of the spectrum, not the absolute magnitude, because emission spectrum, what is on the y-axis, it's arbitrary. It depends on your geometry and detection efficiency and so on. So only the shape of the spectrum is important. But molar absorption coefficient, of course, is absolute number. So that is important. So, and that is very interesting because let's say that now you have your molecule, you have measured the absorption spectrum of acceptor, you have measured the emission spectrum of the donor, then you can calculate J. You can get the number. And if I go back, then if you have J, and then you use some approximation for the orientation, and then you can determine the radiative rate constant for donor, and then you can calculate the rate, and you can calculate the distance dependence of the rate. So that is, you can absolutely calculate the energy transfer rate, and it turns out that this is remarkably good theory. It works very, very well. So there are many, many tests for the theory, and I show you just one test and one example from our own work. And this kind of experiment has been done where people have synthesized a rigid molecule, in this case, a steroid molecule, which has a very rigid backbone. So you know exactly what is the geometry of it. And then you attach molecule on one end, acceptor molecule and donor end molecule on the other end. And then you basically know the distance, and then you can do the experiment and determine the energy transfer rate. And what happens is that when you model a molecular modeling for the distance, it would give 21 angstroms, and first the theory would give 19 angstroms, basically same value. So this is just one example of experimental tests, and it works extremely well. So, and because it works extremely well, you can actually use this theory as a basis for a tool like a ruler. So this really works. Of course, it has its limitations. So when the molecules go really, really close together, when we have a different mechanism coming into play, and then it's not so easy. But over several nanometers, this works very well. And so the scale for this energy transfer is on the order of nanometers. So roughly from 1 to 10 nanometers is the scale where this works. When you go beyond 10 nanometers, it starts already to get slow, because you remember that there is a 6th power. So of course it's quite strong dependence of the distance. But anyway, so when the molecules are roughly from 1 to 10 nanometers, there is efficient energy transfer. This is from our own work example. So we have prepared kind of hybrid molecule where they have a gold cluster molecule. So this is a gold core, and we have an organic ligand layer, and then we have attached molecule. So we call this KU dye. It looks like this, and this dye is a molecule which is a fluorescent molecule. And here you see the overlap. So the gold cluster is here the acceptor, and the KU dye is the donor. And the acceptor, it absorbs over a very broad range, and the blue one is a KU emission. So you see there is a nice overlap with the emission and absorption. So there is energy transfer, and it happens that when the molecules are attached, it's where they are very close, and energy transfer is very efficient, and it's basically quenches emission. You don't see any emission. Then when they detach, you activate the emission again. And what happens interestingly is that this association dissociation depends on pH. So here, this makes a spectroscopic pH sensor. So for example, here, blue is low pH. At low pH, they separate. So this is the emission spectrum of KU. You see nice emission. But when you go to high pH, emission dies off when it's because they attach again. So this is now depending on pH, you get emission or not, and that makes a nice fluorescent pH sensor. This is a calculation, first calculation, and this gives you idea of the distance. So this is a distance between them. We have to remember that the distance it's not straightforward to determine exactly the distance because where you take the center to be. So there is a little bit uncertainty there, but roughly. So and on the left we have energy transfer rate. On the right we have fluorescence quantum yield, and this is a calculation based on spectra. And here we see that energy transfer rate. When they are really attaching each other, we are close to here. We have about 10 to 12 seconds to minus one rate for the energy transfer. And then if we go to 6-8 nanometer, we go 10 to 7, 10 to 8. And from there, we can calculate the fluorescence quantum yield because we know the quantum yield for fluorescence without energy transfer. And then that shows that at short distance, fluorescence quantum yield is really, really, really small, 10 to minus 5. So this sort of 20. Then we have to go to something like 8 nanometers so that fluorescence returns. So this again shows nicely that between 1 to 10, we have either total quenching or returning of fluorescence. So we use this complex to make intracellular pH sensor, where we actually bind them covalently together, and they make a hybrid molecule. And cells take inside this hybrid molecule in so-called endosome. So this is it basically goes to the surface, and from surface it makes this vesicle, and the vesicle then contains these molecules. In a vesicle, they get hydrolyzed and separated, but they remain in a vesicle. And when the vesicles move, they start to get acidified. So when they acidify, the complex separates, and then you activate fluorescence. And this we can see in bioimaging. So these are images of cells. When we start, you see basically nothing. This is fluorescent image. There are many cells. These are the cells. But when you wait 2 hours, you start to see activation of fluorescence. And this is after endosomes acidified. So we start to see the fluorescence. and after overnight, we have a lot of fluorescence. So this shows vesicles, endosomes, where the hybrid is, and it indicates that pH has lowered. Okay, and downstairs we have on the left we have basically, or on the right we have dye only, so it doesn't work without the cluster so well. And I think there's a mistake here. It should be that on the left we have good fluorescence, and then we introduce a molecule which disrupts these vesicles, and they escape from the endosomes, these molecules, and then you get faint fluorescence. And on the right, dye only doesn't show anything. So this shows an example how this kind of energy transfer can lead to a nice application. So basically, fluorescence pH sensor. It's based on this energy transfer effect. Okay, so now we go to the electron exchange mechanism, and this is called Dexter theory, according to Mr. Dexter, who developed it. But this is, so first the energy is effective over small and large distances, so from 1 to 10 nanometers. So from the collision distance over to about 10 nanometers. But when molecules collide, the electronic wave functions overlap, and there is a possibility for electron exchange. And then we have this exchange mechanism active. And it's a bit more tricky, this theory, but basically the energy transfer rate is proportional to this expression, which is a little bit different because there is now, we still have J, which is the spectral overlap. We need to have resonant condition anyway, and we have some factor K, but the distance dependence is exponential. And there, I will explain soon more, but that is a key point. So in this mechanism, it's exponential distance dependence. Because the interaction between wave functions dies off exponential. Okay? So the first factor, K, is something which depends on specific orbital interaction. So in order to really calculate that, you need a quantum chemical calculation. So it's, we cannot say much about that. Then we have the spectral overlap integral, but it is the difference to first the theory is that it's normalized according to the absorption coefficient. So it only means that we only need the resonant condition, but we don't need to have a, for example, large oscillator strength. And then we have the distance, which is now exponential distance dependence, and L is the van der Waals distance. Okay, so basically leaving van der Waals distance. So here, this shows the how the overlap integral J is formed in Dexter theory. So the term on the right-hand side is the same as for the first theory, but the A factor is means that we also normalize the molar absorption coefficient. So basically we take the full integral of that and normalize with that. So the difference is that for first theory, of course, we need strong spectroscopic transitions, but for Dexter theory, no need for strong or large oscillator strength, just the resonant condition is enough. So we can compare. So for first, there's a long range. It's inverse 6 power of distance dependence, and Dexter short range, it's exponential. And for first, it depends on oscillator strengths for the donor and acceptor transitions, but Dexter does not depend on oscillator strengths. Okay, next one is basically the same thing, and both depend on the spectral overlap integral. So we can expect Dexter to function over collision distance and first then from collision to the large distance. But Dexter will not work over large distances. Now we go through 4 different possible cases for energy transfer, and they have different features which we will discuss. So first one is singlet energy transfer. So what do we mean by that? So we have this equation showing the what happens in the reaction, and we have the initial state is donor excited singlet and acceptor singlet, and on the right hand side we have donor ground singlet and acceptor excited state singlet. So we have 2 transitions. If you look, the donor transition, it's a singlet transition, and the acceptor transition is a singlet singlet. So both are individually allowed transitions, and overall this is allowed singlet-singlet transition. And both mechanisms are allowed. And then if you perform experiments, it's not so easy to distinguish which one is occurring, but there are some tricks. If we have a solution, and if we have energy transfer, we excite one of the molecules. And then what happens is that, of course, molecules diffuse in the liquid. But if you think about Dexter mechanisms, in order for energy transfer to occur, they must collide. So they must come to close distance. Whereas first mechanism can work over distance, so they don't have to necessarily collide. They can be over large distance. So that means that for Dexter mechanism, if the energy transfer rate itself is very large, as it usually is, then the reaction can become diffusion limit. So when we observe the rate for energy transfer, it may be same as a diffusion coefficient for molecules. And if that happens, if Let me see. If the observed energy transfer rate is similar to the diffusion coefficient for the molecule, and if you perform the experiment in different solvents with different viscosity, where the diffusion rate changes, then it is presumably exchange mechanism is the dominant. Whereas if, for example, energy transfer rate is much larger than the diffusion coefficient rate, and it is insensitive to viscosity, then it is presumably Coulombic mechanism. Of course, it can happen that both are occurring simultaneously. Then, of course, if we have, for example, very low acceptor molar absorption coefficient, presumably then exchange mechanism is the dominant one. But if you have high acceptor molar absorption coefficient, this presumably then Coulombic mechanism is the dominant. Okay, the next case, triplet energy transfer. What does that mean? Now, the excited donor is triplet state, and the acceptor is single state. And what happens is that the donor triplet relaxes to single state. So it is formally forbidden, spin forbidden, and the acceptor is excited to triplet state. So this is also formally forbidden transition, but the overall, you see on the left, we have triplet singlet, on the right, we have singlet triplet. So the overall transition is spin allowed, but individual transitions are not, they are spin forbidden. That means that oscillator strength will be very, very small. So then we can immediately say that Coulombic mechanism is forbidden, but exchange mechanism is allowed. So this occurs by exchange mechanism, and this is actually very important mechanism because the triplet state is very long-lived. So there is a plenty of time for it to go around and meet molecules, collide with them, and exchange energy. So this is the mechanism that is behind, for example, this quenching by oxygen that we had a demo exercise on. And it is indeed that this long lifetime of the triplet state makes this very, very important mechanism. And this is most common mechanism in organic photochemistry. The previous mechanism is fully allowed, but singlet state is usually very short-lived, many, many orders of magnitude short-lived. So there may not be sufficient time for energy transfer to occur. So this is the dominant energy transfer in organic photochemistry. Then we have triplet singlet. So there we have a excited triplet state, both singlet state, and the acceptor singlet state is excited to singlet state. So we see that the donor transition is forbidden, but acceptor transition is allowed, but overall it's forbidden because we have triplet singlet and on the right singlet singlet. So overall reaction is spin forbidden. So this seems to be not very common. And so it's Coulomb mechanism is spin forbidden, so it doesn't really work. Exchange mechanism is spin forbidden, so both mechanisms are forbidden. So this is a rare mechanism and with a small rate constant. But some examples exist, and still we have the long lifetime of the triplet state, which compensates the small rate constant. So this is a rare mechanism. Both mechanisms are forbidden, but still there are some examples. Whereas finally we have singlet triplet energy transfer. So now the donor is singlet transition, acceptors singlet triplet. And overall, it's forbidden, and we have a short-lived excited state. So this must be very, very rare mechanism. So everything is forbidden and short lifetime. But there is one example mentioned in the book. So quenching of anthracene derivatives by naphthalene. So there are some examples. They usually can be observed if other mechanisms for some reason do not really work. I'm not aware of the details of this mechanism, but. Anyway, this is extreme. Yeah, okay, so there the singlet energy transfer is very improbable due to large endothermicity. So this is uphill reaction energetics. So this one is very rare. The previous one is also rare, and the dominant mechanism is a triplet. Triplet energy and the singlet, they are more common ones. Here, of course, we have heavy atom effect, which makes these formerly spin forbidden transitions more allowed. It helps in this mechanism. Okay, so now we end the energy transfer part here. And the key points are that, first of all, energy transfer is fairly common. And for example, it's good to know that if you have a molecule which has maybe something like emission spectrum like that, maybe. But then if you measure and it can somehow disturb, for example, like this, so you are missing part of it. You have to investigate, maybe in the solution there is a molecule which has absorption here. So this is an indication that something like a radiative energy transfer mechanism may be happening. Apart from that, we have two non-radiative energy transfer mechanisms, which we call Foerster and Dexter, so Coulomb and exchange. And this Foerster mechanism works, it's a dipole-dipole interaction. It works over long distances in molecular scale up to about from 1 to 10 nanometers. And there, the rate depends on oscillator strengths of absorption and emission transitions. So basically, you can calculate it by considering the radiative lifetime or rate constant for donor and molar absorption coefficient of spectrum of the acceptor. And then you have the overlap integral, which gives you the resonance condition. And the distance dependence is 1/r^6. And you can calculate this rate from spectroscopic information. That is the nice thing. Then for the Dexter or exchange mechanism, it basically occurs at the collision distance. And it has exponential distance dependence. And then we have these different mechanisms where triplet energy transfer is the most dominant one for organic photochemistry because of the long lifetime of the triplet state and overall spin allowed reaction. All right, so now we go to electron transfer. So here we transfer electron instead of energy. And this is also quite common phenomenon. Well, we start from photoionization. So we already discussed XPS and UPS photoelectron spectroscopy. And there we have already discussed this process where the ionized molecules and eject electrons from the bound state to continue. And of course, we have ionization energy or ionization potential, which is the energy needed to ionize a molecule. And we have many of them. We have first and second and nth, because we can actually ionize molecule further. And this shows typical ionization potentials for gas phase. So we are talking about 10 electron volts, which correspond in terms of wavelength. So this is the equivalent energy, a wavelength of electromagnetic radiation of energy corresponding to this ionization potential. We see that it corresponds to radiation with about 100 nanometer wavelength, so deep UV range. Now, so that is gas phase, but when we go to condensed phase, we have very large effect of solvation. So if you take cation, you take electrons and let them be solvated, it reduces greatly the energy needed for ionization. For example, in water, if I take my molecule in aquaspace, it radiates, I produce positive ion and electron. And when the electron goes to water. It is a real species, it's something we can observe. And this is solvent, and this solvation energy is very large. It means that these ionic states become low in energy. And so this electron is a very powerful reducing agent. And if we produce electrons in water, they are very reactive. So it's a transient species. Unless we have something, a solution which makes them stable. Electron in a solution then can be attached to a solvent molecule. It can induce reactions. And I want to emphasize this effect. This is, of course, for chemists very common. We are talking about solvation energy of ions. And good example to think about it is to consider acid molecules. If you take hydrochloric acid, what do we have there? We have ions. We have protons, and protons form these oxonium ions, H3O plus, which can become solvated. And then we have chloride ions. But if I take HCl molecule, it's a diatomic molecule, covalently bound molecule. If I dissociate that, it dissociates to neutral atoms, H plus chlorine atom. And this is quite large energy. I think it's about 4.5 electron volts. If I want to dissociate this to ions, H plus Cl minus, I need much, much more energy. Basically, I need energy equal to we need to ionize here. Plus electron ionization energy, and then but that goes higher, and then we come down with the electron affinity of chlorine, because this reaction involves E minus plus Cl becomes Cl minus. So here we gain energy. But anyway, this is very high, maybe 10 electron volts. But still, if I put this molecule in solute in water, it spontaneously dissociates to ions, because I have tremendously large solvation energy. So here we have H plus aqueous plus Cl minus aqueous. So this solvation energy is so large that overall energy goes even below this minimum. So the molecule tends to dissociate to solvated ions. So we are talking about large energy in solvation of ions. Of course, because water is a polar molecule, so it's these dipoles orient around ions, and we have very large energies, solvation energies. This is an example of a photochemical reaction. We can have naphthalene in acetonitrile. We irradiate, we detach electrons, so we get naphthalene cation. And electron and electron attached to the acetonitrile. And these can be observed, but they are transient and they recombine, and there is no net reaction. But if you put something in a solution, which is called electron scavenger, something which likes electrons, then electron can be transferred permanently. And even photochemistry can happen. For example, now we have electron on acetonitrile, but if we add bromobenzene, this likes to take the electron and it creates the neutral solvent molecule. And radical, benzene radical, and bromide ion. So this kind of more permanent photochemical reaction may happen. So we can have these ionic reactions occurring when which involve electron transfer. Okay, so now let's take a look on the electron transfer reactions from the theoretical point of view. So these are very important, one very fundamental. Photo-induced chemical reactions, of course, photosynthesis involves electron transfer. We've already learned that it involves also energy transfer. And conventional photography was based on electron transfer reaction. But now we like to understand a bit more the process. So here is our process. We have, again, we have donor and acceptor, but not this time, not energy donor or acceptor, but electron donor and electron acceptor. So we get, and electron transfer occurs without photoexcitation also. So of course we have a lot of electron transfer reactions, but excited state molecule, because it's at higher energy, it is very prominent electron transfer donor. So that's why this concerns a lot the photochemists. So we have excited molecule, Ramstedt molecule. An excited molecule gives electron, transfers electron to the acceptor molecule, and we get ion pair or two ions. So we basically have two simultaneous processes, oxidation of the donor and reduction of the acceptor. And these also are related to electrochemistry via oxidation potential and reduction potential. Basic energy needed to oxidize or reduce molecule. And this diagram shows you that excited state molecule is more prominent or better electron donor and acceptor than the ground state molecule at the same time. So if you look on the left, this part of the diagram, so we have orbital diagram. And on the left, we have ground state molecule. So we have two electrons on homo orbital, no electrons on lumo orbital. And if we consider reduction, reduction means attachment of electron to the molecule. Now, when electron from vacuum, basically from a free state, is attached to the molecule, it goes to the lumo orbital. So, and this difference is electron affinity. So that this is how much we gain energy in this reaction. Now, if you go to the right, we have excited state molecule. Now we have a partially occupied homo and lumo. And as you can see, electron can now go to homo orbital. And that is larger, then electron affinity is larger than for the ground state molecule. So it is better reducing agent reduction. And then if you go to the right, we see oxidation. So starting again from the left part, we have the ground state molecule with two electrons on homo, no electrons on lumo. And if we want to ionize, we ionize from the homo orbital to the vacuum, and that is ionization potential. But on the right, we have again excited state molecule. And as you can see, now we can ionize from the lumo orbital, and then ionization energy or potential is small. So that's why we see that this excited state molecule is it's a very prominent acceptor or donor in electron transfer reactions, because we have already put energy into it. Okay, so now what happens is that, well, we can have a reaction where we have direct electron transfer, photochemical of photo assisted electron transfer. So transfer of electron from donor to acceptor. But usually that involves also thermal reaction, and we have to consider how this kind of, what happens in this kind of electron transfer reaction. There, this solvent reorganization becomes a key point. So, and here in this diagram, we can understand this growth. So, up here we have a diagram where we have on the left we have kind of the initial situation, and for simplicity, we actually have the same molecule R, which can be either donor or acceptor. It's possible. And when we, and on the y-axis, we have free energy. So basically, this is Gibbs free energy. So involving all possible intramolecular interactions. So we start from left, where we have electron jumps. And we have R plus plus R. So we have positive ion R and neutral R. And they look different because they look different. They are different. And then when electron transfer occurs, again, motion of electrons is very, very fast. So nuclei don't have time to move. And then there's electron jump. So now electron jumps from R to R plus, and we get this situation, R plus R plus. But when the electron jumps, we have both, they are not optimally solvated because they have a wrong solvation, which was adjusted for R plus plus R, but now we have R plus R plus. And then we need solvent reorganization. So because of this solvent lacking proper configuration, this goes uphill in energy, this electron jump. But when the solvent reorganizes, we get back to the right, and which of course has the same energy as initial point, but this time R plus R plus. And then now the solvation has changed so that R plus is solvated as an ion and R as a neutral molecule. So there is energy, free energy caused for this reaction to happen. So electron has jumped, but simultaneously we need solvent reorganization. And that tells us that we need some activation energy for this reaction to occur. And down here, we have a pictorial representation of what happens to solvent molecules in this reaction. So this likes to illustrate the importance of solvation and solvation reorganization in electron transfer. Now we have a theory for electron transfer which aims for calculation of the rate. And that is by Marcus. Rudy Marcus got the Nobel Prize for this theory. And it is in principle simple, but it works very well. So it has been proved to work remarkably well. And there are a couple of principles there. First, electron transfer occurs much faster than the nuclei move in accordance with the Frank Condon principle. So again, we come into the same principle of fast electron process. The initial state and the final state have different charge distribution, and consequently the solvent accepts a different equilibrium configuration around them. So solvent has to move, and in a thermal reaction, the activation energy is determined by the crossing point between the initial and final state potential surfaces, as we will soon see. And with these approximations, then the reaction rate is calculated from an Arrhenius type of expression if the activation energy is known. So Arrhenius equation is an expression for rate of a chemical reaction, and it gives the temperature dependent. It looks like this. So we have a e to the minus a. So this is a very general expression for processes which are thermally activated. So there is a barrier, and this barrier we in chemistry we call activation energy. So now the reaction rate goes exponentially with respect to temperature, and electron or activation energy is the key parameter. So lighter the barrier, the slower the rate. But anyway, this is very common general expression for reactions which are thermally activated. So we need something where we start from here. We have barrier, and this is our activation energy. And we need to jump over the barrier if we want to make a reaction. And thermal energy gives us attempts to go over the barrier. So that is the principle behind it. Okay, so Marcus made this actually very, very simple theory, where he describes the situation with two parabolas. And of course, this is a simplification, but it gives proper behavior for the system. So we have a first parabola, which is the starting point. So they have donor, and then we have molecules in between, and acceptor, neutral. And then the final state is where the electron transfer has occurred, D plus, A minus. Okay? And so and this is not the potential energy curve in a sense that we have encountered with spectroscopy, but this is a free energy curve. They involve all the motions of solvent molecules and molecule itself. So basically giving us the energy, Gibbs free energy profile. So starting point is to describe this starting situation with the free energy parabola, and we are here at equilibrium. We are here. And then we have energy electron transfer. And after that, we have ions, D plus and A minus. And this we describe with the second parabola, okay? And now in this reaction, we have exothermic reaction, which we described delta G zero. So then this right-hand parabola is lower energy. And then that means that necessarily they must cross somewhere, these parabolas. And this crossing point is taken as activation energy, delta G, what is hashtag. And these smooth curves are true situation when we have properly taken into account all the quantum mechanical interactions, but we can approximate this delta G hashtag with the crossing point of the parabolas. And then we have key parameters, exothermicity, delta G zero, delta G hashtag. And we have third parameter, which is lambda, and this is called reorganization energy. So that is, as we can see, it is a difference between minimum of the final state. So this is the final equilibrium state of the reaction after electron transfer and the energy at the initial state, but taken to the, this reaction parabola. So it means that if I arbitrarily would move electron here, I would go up here. And after that, if I start from this point, solvent will reorganize and I come down here all the way. Okay. So that's the reorganization energy of the solvent. I make the electron transfer and I let the solvent adjust and then I gain this much energy. Okay. And now using this diagram, we can calculate the rate. And the rate is according to Arrhenius. So we want to calculate the rate for electron transfer, and it is Arrhenius type of equation, and we only need two parameters. We need A, which is kind of a three exponential factor, but then we need delta G aspect, so the activated energy. Now A term is difficult to calculate, but there are some approximations to it, and it's a quantum mechanical, but it is a weak function of temperature, and we can approximate this with some numerical factor. So this is not the key point. But the point is that we can calculate the activation energy from reorganization energy and exothermicity with, according to this formula. And this actually is it's a funny thing. Where do we get this equation is from this picture. So maybe I put demo exercise to you, but it is really so that this is mathematical. If I define these parabolas like this, and I give you these parameters, then if you just calculate the crossing point of these two parabolas, it turns out that it is actually this expression. Okay, so it comes from the model. All right. So that relates then the activation energy to reorganization energy and exothermicity of the reactions. So as here is the explanation for the reorganization energy again, so free energy change between the final state at equilibrium and the final state at the equilibrium configuration of the initial state. Okay. Now, it is interesting that if delta G0 is zero, that means that it is exothermicity is zero, if I go back, then in fact, this would correspond to, you see that lambda would correspond to this difference between the minimum of the initial state and the vertical transition to the final state energy curve. And that would correspond to optical excitation, electron transfer, charge transfer excitation. So in this situation, one can observe this energy from spectrum, where if I can identify charge transfer excitation, it would go overlap with this. Okay. And then in that case, really, and if exothermicity is small, then we can approximately obtain the reorganization energy from spectroscopy. But more generally, so optical excitation energy is reorganization energy plus delta G0. Okay. So, and now we come to the key point. So when this theory is used and you calculate the rate and you modify the exothermicity, interesting prediction occurs. So basically we have different range errors. So first, if in a so-called normal region, we have so delta G is smaller than zero, so we have exothermic reaction. But that is larger than minus lambda. Anyway, so this is a region when if we increase the exothermicity, we are in this kind of region. I will draw it here. So we start from here. And so we have this exothermicity, and we start increasing the exothermicity. This potential goes down with respect to initial state, and you see that if it goes down, the activation energy decreases. Right. So if I move it down, so this is kind of intuitive that if exothermicity increases, one would expect that the rate would go up, and indeed, if the activation energy goes down, then the rate goes up. Okay. Activation energy decreases and the reaction rate increases. So this is normal region. But then comes a point when it is like this. So there is no activation energy anymore. That means that the rate is at maximum. But if it still increases exothermicity, we go, it's a little difficult to draw, but the crossing point moves up on the left. So the activated energy starts to go up again. So the rate will decrease, even though the exothermicity increases. This is kind of non-intuitive. So this is so-called inverted region. Exothermicity increases strongly, but reaction rate decreases. So this is a prediction from the model. And so it looks like this. So here we have a certain rate, delta G is zero, we have activation. Then we start going to normal region. So the right-hand potential goes down, activation energy decreases. Finally, we come to C point, there is maximum rate. But then here, we introduce a new activation energy and rate goes down again. So this, of course, it was interesting for experimentalists to see if this is actually happening real, because it's quite simple model. I mean, is this something that actually can happen? And it turns out that it is correct. It is correct. So this is test of the Marcus theory. So this is a curve. So we have several experimental points of rate constant for electron transfer reaction. And this each point represents a different experiment. So it is quite heavy experiment involving many molecules, many experiments with different activation energies, different exothermicities for ion pair photoinduced electron transfer. And we can see that rate constant goes up when the delta minus delta G increases up to about 1 eV, and then the rate is from about 5 × 10^11, so very high. I think about starting to be maximum what it can be. And then when the exotherm is increased further, rate goes down again. So it has been tested and shown to be correct. So this behavior is occurring, and it is indeed something which is taken advantage of in nature, and also something we can take advantage of in technological development. For example, I don't have a very detailed example to give, but I just give you an idea that when, if you want to develop, for example, solar cells, they are based on an electron transfer reaction. So you want to separate charges, and you want to collect the charge. Now, you can do it this photo-induced, so you can drive the electron transfer reaction. But the problem is usually back recombination. So when you have a charge separated state, there is a possibility for back recombination. And if that rate is very high, then you don't get net reaction, and that's a problem. But if you design your system so that exotherm has to become very large for the back electron transfer, you may already end up in this inverted region, and the rate for that process can be very slow. So it shows that you can exploit this principle in designing devices for the technological benefit. Okay, so that's all. So basically, we went through now electron transfer as well. And there, it's important to understand the solvation energy of ions is very, very large. And electron transfer reaction is very prominent, especially for excited states, because excited state of a molecule is better for reduction and oxidation than ground state molecule. And there is a theory for electron transfer reactions for calculation of the rate, which is by Marcus, and it's based on this model of two parabolas on a free energy surface. And with a couple of key parameters, the exothermicity, solvent reorganization energy, and activation energy, you can calculate the rate. And you can use spectroscopy to determine the solvation rearrangement energy in some cases. And the theory tells you that there are two regions in behavior of the rate constant. The normal region, where the rate increases with increasing exothermicity, but after a certain point, you enter the inverted region where the rate starts to go down with further increasing of exothermicity. And that effect can be used in design of some devices and technology. All right, good, thanks. So this was the last lecture of the basic course, but we have one more lecture on Thursday for the advanced course, and there we talk about the femtosecond spectroscopy. And then we are done. Questions?
Yeah, about when we get that rate from the last Wednesday's test.
Oh, yeah. Not very soon, because I have very busy schedule now. So I should probably goes to the end of the week. So I can try to get them by Friday or latest Sunday, but not in a couple of few days. I have very busy schedule. Sorry. Yep, thanks. Thank you.